This is Rabbi Jeffrey Sachs, editor of Tradition, with another Tradition podcast, in which we bring you conversations with our authors and editors about things going on in the pages of our Journal of Orthodox Jewish Thought. Please visit traditiononline.org to see what we've been up to, and to renew your subscription to our print journal or for digital-only access. Or perhaps you'd like to gift a subscription to a new reader, maybe to a younger person. Also, visit Tradition Journal on Facebook and give us a like. Keep updated on everything happening at Tradition. In 1994, we ran one of the most significant essays in our now 60-plus year history, Professor Chaim Soloveitchik's Rupture and Reconstruction, The Transformation of Contemporary Orthodoxy. Visit our archives to read it. To mark the 25th anniversary of Rupture and Reconstruction, Tradition has just released our full 2019 issue, containing what I think is a fascinating symposium exploring the enduring relevance of what Professor Soloveitchik wrote way back in 1994. Keep an eye on traditiononline.org for the variety of accompanying digital-only essays and commentary to complement what appeared in this most current print issue. We're also bringing you podcasts with some of the contributors. In this episode, Rabbi Daniel Karapkin and Rabbi Chaim Strauchler sit down to discuss each other's contributions to the symposium. Rabbi Karapkin is the rabbi of Bayit, Congregation Beth Avraham Yosef of Toronto. Rabbi Strauchler leads Shari Shemayim, also in Toronto. Daniel is currently serving as the president of the Rabbinical Council of America, the longtime publisher of Tradition. Chaim is also an officer of the organization and recently joined our ranks as an associate editor of Tradition. They sat down together to discuss issues that echo from the pages of Rupture and Reconstruction to their own lives and work, the methods by which faith can be taught, and how they as community rabbis face the challenge of disillusioned orthopraxis. They debate faith's historical fragility within the Jewish people and whether so-called social orthodoxy might classify as a form of mimesis, that term which Chaim Soloveitchik helped introduce into the modern Orthodox lexicon a quarter century ago. Here's their conversation.
So Rabbi Karapkin, in your article, you introduce the idea of social orthodoxy into the discussion about Rupture and Reconstruction. And in so doing, you inject an idea that Rabbi Soloveitchik, or Dr. Soloveitchik, does not pay as much attention to. And focusing on the mimesis as opposed to the text culture, he does not address another side of the sociology of our community, and that is, you might say, a lived Judaism without either mimesis or attention to text. Would you like to express a little bit about what your insertion of social orthodoxy does to Rupture and Reconstruction?
Well, my observation is that Dr. Soloveitchik was definitely onto something, but he was observing what is a continuous evolutionary process. And unfortunately, it has not, the evolution of North American Orthodox Jewry has not aged well in the last 25 years. So that whereas a person in the past who was just going along with the program because they went to Jewish day school, they grew up in a Jewish community, in the past it was a given that that person harbored faith in God and at least a modicum of that spiritual commitment and an understanding that there is a God. Today, we can't take that for granted. That was what Jay Lefkowitz's article on social orthodoxy that came out 5 years ago in Commentary Magazine really underscored, in that he was trying to articulate what is for him and a whole cadre of other young North American Jews is just the new normal. And that is, we go to shul, sometimes we daven, sometimes we don't daven, but we don't necessarily believe in God. And that's the natural evolution, because if you don't have that, you know, what Dr. Soloveitchik called that God of immanence, the God of Tevye, the milkman, where you feel the Ribono Shel Olam in everything that you do, which is what we lost when we transitioned from the old country to the new country. So then it's only a matter of time when that, the lack of immanence starts to cause an erasure, an invisibility of the transcendent God to be no longer even there.
If I can challenge the philosophical or the theological side of Rabbi Soloveitchik's article, which it certainly is there, he speaks about this sort of basic faith and almost fear of God that existed in a pre-modern or an early modern era. But Jay Lefkowitz's theory of social orthodoxy might be called mimesis, that he describes a certain transmission of practice and of social organization that for him is Judaism. And might we say that this is a separate and distinct, almost a countertextual vision of Judaism that might have its own legitimacy, according to Dr. Soloveitchik's theory?
Well, whether it's mimetic or textual is not really so much of the issue. The point is that what Dr. Soloveitchik was describing that existed in the old country was a God of that was present in everything that we did and lived. And today, you know, is it a form of Judaism? Of course it's a form of Judaism. Mordechai Kaplan described it as it's what Lefkowitz himself says, that is Reconstructionist Judaism. It has all of the trappings of orthodoxy, but it's orthoprax and not orthodox. And that's not something I believe that is sustainable. I don't think that if that's the legacy that's being passed on to our kids, and I think that you and I as pulpit rabbis, we see that in the pews. We see the JFKers, you know, the Just for Kiddushers, the people who really do, from a social standpoint, really integrate well within an Orthodox Jewish community, but really don't have any emuna. And how can that perpetuate? That's the sort of the thing that plagues us. It sort of keeps us up at night. I'm just a few years older than you, so I have a married child who lives in a very Orthodox Jewish community. And she tells me that when she gets together with her friends and they talk about school issues and shul issues, sometimes she's quite taken aback because a lot of her peers who send their children to the same, very same Jewish day school, and perhaps even the women dress the same and the men wear the kippah, but they're not necessarily practicing the same kind of Judaism that you or I are practicing. Maybe in front of the world stage, in front of the Jewish community, they have the same appearance as Orthodox Jews, but behind closed doors, Shabbos is not a Shabbos, and observance is not the same kind of observance. And that's being born from people who went to Jewish day school, who grew up in an Orthodox Jewish home, but have somehow dropped off of faith. Now, in all fairness, I'm not sure that it was a lot different from when we were growing up. There were always people like that. But it has become more socially acceptable.
So I want to push back on you in terms of the sustainability of social orthodoxy, because Lefkowitz does not seem to think that it's at risk. In other words, he seems to think that this is a viable model, and this was true for his father had it, and he'll pass it on to his children as far as he's concerned. And I'd like to quote from the Psik de Rabbi Kahana, where they describe the pasuk in Sefer Yirmiyahu, and they interpret Halavai Osia Zavu V'Sorasi Shamaru, that it's entirely possible, and almost Halavai, if only the Jewish people were to observe the Torah and abandon God, that would be great. And on a certain level, this has existed and is existing right now, where you have Jews who are abandoned God and faith in God, but are observing the Torah on whatever level, and they remain socially connected to the Jewish people and to Halacha too on some level. So in as much as we have this within our tradition, maybe we should say that, you know, let's encourage as many people as possible to remain socially orthodox and not question its sustainability.
But, well, listen, don't get me wrong. I totally agree, and I once gave a drush about this. I said, if you are socially orthodox, if you no longer believe in God for whatever reason, for whatever experience you had, for whatever you read on social media that sort of shattered your faith system, I still want you to come to shul. I want you to, but what's the reason? halavai osi ozavu v'mitzvosai shamaru. The reason is because there's a confidence that Chazal have that they're bringing out from the prophet that basically says that the practice of mitzvot will, for many people, not for all, but for many people, the practice of mitzvot itself engenders emunah. Or as the Sefer HaChinuch writes, Ha'adam nifal kefi pu'ulotav, that a person is shaped and formed by his behavior. And that the Sefer HaChinuch writes that in the context of, why did God give us so many mitzvot? Would it not have been sufficient for us to demonstrate our devotion with 200 instead of 613? And he writes, this is the way that God engenders emunah. But, and here's the big but, and that is that it's not a guarantee. It's not a guarantee. If a person actively is living within a society which is cynical and which views faith in God or God himself as being a throwback to an ancient time where man needed to make sense of a senseless world, or if he views religion as delusional, and then I don't feel that going through the motions for social convenience is a good recipe for sustainability.
So that this brings us to the end of your article, in which you speak about educating towards faith. And you are the author of a translation of the Kuzari, which does deal with the construction of faith and how it is that you can bring a person not just to Shmiras HaMitzvos, but also to Emunah and Hashem and faith in God. And so what would you say as far as a program by which to take someone who is socially orthodox and to better raise them within an educational system, or after, post that system, what can be done to engender faith in the soul of such a person?
Well, it's the $64 question that all of us are struggling with.
Only $64?
Yes, $64,000 probably, or $64 billion question. This is what we're all struggling with, and first of all, I think to answer that question, it's a multifaceted issue. I think it depends on the age. One thing that I can tell you for sure doesn't work is to do what we're currently doing. The status quo doesn't work. We are sending our children, thank God, for those of us who can afford to do so, which is itself an issue, but if we can afford to do so, we're sending our kids to 12 plus years of grade school in the finest of yeshivas who have dedicated themselves to the highest levels of pedagogical excellence and really well-trained teachers who know their stuff and are imparting really good teachings to our children. When you and I were growing up, it was a given that if you went through 12 years of yeshiva, 8 years of elementary school, 4 years of high school, and then you went on to your gap year in Eretz Yisrael, then it was a given that you were part of the Orthodox community. It's not a given anymore. There are people who are going through the entire system, and kids, even in the finest, regardless of the hashkafa of the yeshiva, whether it's modern Orthodox, centrist Orthodox, yeshivish Orthodox, there are kids who are sitting, whether it's boys with their tefillin on, who are blankly staring into space during tefillah, or whether it's young ladies who are completely disenchanted. Go ahead.
So if I can just interrupt for a quick moment, and as much as you're saying it was a given then, I think that we're overestimating the past and setting expectations that are too high. You and I have chaverim who went off the derech too.
We do, but they're no longer part of the Orthodox community, and they were far and few in between. At least that's my memory.
I have friends who went off the derech and are not totally outside the community. They dabble.
Okay, I hear you. Listen, I could be, maybe I'm a little bit more than a few years older, but the point is that we can't leave inyane emunah anymore for the next teacher who's going to come along. The reason why our teachers, God bless them, and you and I are teachers to a certain degree, the reason why we gloss over these subjects is because they are so difficult, and they're not simple. It's not like being able to pick apart a piece of Gemara and say, Rashi says this, Tosfos says this, the Rashba says this, the Shulchan Aruch says this, and we have everything spread out before us. These are very complex issues, and they have to be approached very carefully. And even once we have approached them, there are going to be gray areas that are unanswered. Unfortunately, we can no longer shield our children from the gray. We want to present them with black and white, but at a certain age, they have to be exposed to the gray and discuss issues of emunah, understand the difference between the Rabbi Yehuda Halevi's approach and the Rambam's approach, whether God is a transcendent God, whether he's an immanent God, whether the key to our emunah is bichina, like the Chavos HaLevavos says, and the Rambam say, that you have to think about intellectually about creation and come to an understanding of God yourself, or whether you rely on a Mesorah, like Rabbi Yehuda Halevi says. All of these issues have to be spread out on the table for our children, especially today. And that's sort of the one step. But you also asked me about what do we do with our grown-ups, the ones that you and I are trying to serve as best as we can. And I grapple with it, and I think that it's not a monolithic answer. I think that there are going to be some people who will be able to be inspired through Iyun Tefillah. Let's teach people more about what the prayers are all about, which have become tasteless for a lot of people. Let's get more people involved in Shiurim. A lot of it is one-on-one. The Kiruv movement of the 80s and 90s is now within our Orthodox shuls. And we have to learn what it means to... We have to learn Kiruv techniques of being able to create meaningful relationships and at the same time presenting our congregants who are intellectually sophisticated with sophisticated Torah education.
So if I can go back to the beginning of your answer to the question about training towards emunah, in regards to the status quo and the status quo's success, I would take the position that the status quo is working on some level. True that there's always room for improvement. Baruch Hashem, we have a beautiful Jewish community. Baruch Hashem, there's so much Limud HaTorah in our generation, and there's so much Shmiras HaMitzvos. There's so much chesed, there's so much commitment to community within our ranks. And I would argue that it's important for us to recognize that emunah is a rare and special quantity that throughout our history has not always been very strong. That there's been plenty of avodah zarah and Tanakh among our people. And there have been plenty of apostates throughout the periods of the Talmud and beyond. And the expectation that we're going to bat 1,000 is misplaced.
I would agree with you. I think that we can't be overly pessimistic, and there's a lot of reasons for optimism. And I really do want to segue into your article with that, because you are much more optimistic in your prognostication than I am. So maybe we can talk a little bit about your article. Listen, but you know, just as the last word on this issue, I agree with you. We're doing a lot of things right. I would just note that the one thing that is different today is that today's society is more godless than it ever was in my lifetime. That godlessness has become the prevailing attitude of today. Religion is largely being eliminated from the public square, and it is creating an uphill battle for people, for faith leaders like you and I, and not just within the Jewish the Jewish sphere, but among Christian leaders and Muslim leaders as well. Anyway, let's segue into your article. You have an amazing title. You're a great writer, and the title of your article is "Out of a Yoke's Crooked Timber, Faith Might Yet Be Reclaimed." Now, of course, the title itself reveals your optimism towards the end of your article. But I had to actually look up the crooked timber quote, because I looked a little bit familiar, but I didn't know what that was from. Would you just, you know, you're a scholar, so provide us with some of the background of this crooked timber of which you speak.
So it comes from Immanuel Kant, who speaks about the crooked timber of the human material, that we are all somehow crooked in how it is that we are constructed. And he's a little more pessimistic in saying that nothing straight, I think is what he says, was ever made.
Nothing straight can come from a crooked timber. I suppose that as a result of his very Christian outlook, where original sin plays very large in the theology and classical Christian theology of man is doomed to sin and condemned to sin, then it makes a lot of sense to have that attitude that man is crooked and nothing straight can come out of him. But of course, as a Jewish theologian, you have the liberty to say, no, can't. That can't be right. And so your attitude is that, no, we are crooked. There's no question about it. And our Jewish communities are crooked. But you know something? This still can work, and it's working, and it's going to continue to work. So please, if you could elaborate on that.
So I would bridge also to Dr. Soloveitchik's metaphor also of the yoke of halacha, and that is replacing God's hand or that faith, that pure faith of the past. And he's a bit pessimistic in describing that yoke, and I'm trying to redeem that yoke. And I'm arguing that halacha is a structure, it's a framework upon which faith might be experienced. And that the Torah gives us a series of models, whether it be the Beis HaMikdash, or whether it be Tefillah, or whether it be Talmud Torah, as a structure within human existence, where we're able to devote ourselves to God, to be mikarev ourselves before Hashem, and in so doing, in going through those motions, we might be able to experience that pristine faith of which Dr. Soloveitchik hopes that we can experience that faith through those structures. But those structures, that yoke, is crucial for us to be able to experience that divine grace.
Right. So it's funny because I guess you and I are coming at completely diametrically opposite poles. You're coming to take issue with Dr. Soloveitchik because you feel he's being too pessimistic. And my approach was is that if he knew what was down the road 25 years after he wrote his article, he would have been even more pessimistic. So you start off your article by quoting from the sociologist of religion, Charles Taylor, who also does not have a very positive prognostication. But then you sort of come out by saying that, you know, this yoke of halacha really does have a transformative effect. And perhaps it maybe is, it, am I putting words in your mouth if I were to suggest that you believe it might even be a lack of bitachon, a lack of our faith in God or trust in God, to feel that it's hopeless if we're doing everything that we're supposed to do, we have to leave the rest in Hashem's hands.
So I think that the description at the end about a lack of bitachon, I think is also taking a little too hard even on our process and thinking through as religious leaders the task before us. I would say that my argument emphasizes low expectations when it comes to areas of faith. To quote from Rav Amital, ain't patentim, that there are no magic formulas, there are no guarantees when it comes to the religious life. And in as much as we can only do what Hashem asks of us, and we can try our hardest, but it takes two to tango on the interactions between the human and the divine. And there'll be moments when Hashem says, you know what, I'm going to be there with you. But even if we do everything right, there are times where we're not privileged to have Hashem come and be there with us in those moments. And part of the religious endeavor is to do so with that humility, recognizing that it's not in our hands. And this is very hard for moderns, because in modernity, everything is an equation. Everything is a recipe that you follow this self-help guide and you'll get there. And religion does not work that way. Faith does not work that way. It's not all in our hands.
Hmm. There are two thoughts that I have just to add on to what you're saying. One of them is that, you know, the Torah itself says, "Lo meiru bechem mikol ha'amim chashak Hashem bachem vayivchar bachem ki atem hama'at mikol ha'amim." You know, There's this type of exfoliation that happens within the Jewish people every so often. Every time we seem to be increasing and growing, there's something that sort of a falling off that happens in Jewish history. Fortunately, we thank God it's been 80 years since we've experienced the physical tragedy of a Holocaust. But that too was an exfoliation. And the exfoliation that we're experiencing today perhaps is just part of the divine plan. And whoever sticks with the program is part of that very small select elite that Hashem decides in his infinite wisdom that is to remain the kernel of Klal Yisrael for the rest of the world. The other thought that I have is that, you know, up until now we've been focused on what's going on in North America. I don't know if you've addressed it in your sermons over the Yamim Noraim, but I certainly have taken note of the phenomenon that's taking place in Israel today, where even secular Jews are reconnecting with faith issues, with psukim, with especially through the arts, with music, Yishai Ribo, and this whole phenomenon that's taking place today, of where secular Israelis who are not Shomer Shabbos, who do not identify as Dati, but still are learning Tanakh, even learning Talmud. And there seems to be a renaissance of everything Jewish, that you can no longer have a Zionism, you can no longer have an Amamiyut, a nationality in Israel, without the Torah, without Judaism. And I think, you know, Ki Mitzion Teitzei Torah, right? I mean, even if the prognostication, you and I can perhaps look at it half full, half empty, right? But even at the end of the day, if we do acknowledge the failings or the future may not look that bright for North American Jewry, there's a lot to be optimistic about it, what's happening from Zion, from Eretz Yisrael, and hopefully we'll be able to draw from that as well as for our future generations.
Absolutely. There's been an article and a study by Camille Fuchs and by Shmuel Rosner, which they published a couple of years ago, and they called Israel Judaism, this fusing, and they use this to, on a political level, to explain some of the changes within Israeli society between right and left. And it certainly is a point of encouragement to the Jewish project to see the degree to which Judaism has become more rooted within Israeli society. And I think that on a cultural level, on a social level, there's a great deal to be encouraged by in that. I think it's also important to recognize the degree to which the Zionist project's guarantee of no anti-Semitism, once we become like all other nations and have our own state, has not been justified, and that itself is a drive behind this reevaluation of the relationship between Judaism and Zionism. So I think that there certainly is something encouraging within that. And I'd also say, in terms of the assimilation that exists around us in our work, I believe that we, as a modern Orthodox community and as an Orthodox community, it would be problematic for us to accept the fact that there's going to be a certain amount of assimilation. Even though, as I said before, the low expectations, yes, there's going to be a certain amount of assimilation, but we have our moments. And we have, on a social Orthodox level, something worth sharing with a lot of Jews out there who perhaps did not grow up Orthodox and may not be prepared to subscribe to a full degree of orthodoxy, to say to them, well, orthopraxis is something that you might want to consider. That, you know, Shabbos is really wonderful. And Achad Ha'am, getting back to the Zionists, was right when he said that Shabbos keeps the Jews. It really does.
Yeah.
And it's Halavai Osia Zavu Sarasi Shamaru, Shabbasi Shamaru. Can you imagine?
I think Katy Perry said it also, that Shabbat is what keeps her sane. Yeah.
Okay, I'm not familiar with that achron. I'm not familiar with that achron, but we have a wonderful yoke. Our yoke is the best yoke. It's a yoke that, far from being a burden, is a tremendous tool chest that can help people live better, more meaningful lives. And if emunah and God and faith are a part of that, that's going to happen because God says so, and that's going to be great. But even if the Kadosh Baruch Hu does not deign to be present with such a person, the fact that they're living with Shabbos, they're living with Kashrus, with Chesed, with Tzedaka, with all these values, they're going to have a better human experience. And that's something for us to be communicating as Orthodox and Orthopraxis Jews to as many Jews as possible.
Absolutely, I agree. So on that, we certainly agree 100%.
Okay, so we've had an opportunity to speak for about half an hour now, and I want to thank Rav Karapkin for joining me in recording these thoughts on rupture and reconstruction, and to thank you, the listener, for joining us in the conversation as well. And both of us are rabbis of communities where we get lots of talk back. And if you'd like to join our communities in that conversation, we'd love to hear what you think.
Thanks so much. And if you have any ideas about how to restore faith to our social fabric in the Orthodox community, or if you disagree and you feel like there's no loss of faith at all and everyone is still a maimon, we want to hear from you as well. And Rabbi Strachler, it's always a pleasure. And I really do feel blessed that we're in the same city together, even if not the same community.
Baruch Hashem. And please come and join us and visit us in Toronto and Thornhill.
That's right.
Yashar Koach. Thank you so much.
Thank you.